sorry that the result was as it was, while those from the Gulf states were sour, not inclined to talk. This only applied to the enlisted men, however. Without exception, he found the officers spiteful as hornets. By journalistic license, another reporter deduced from what he saw that the common people of the South cared very little which way the war ended, so long as it ended soon. Sullen or friendly, spiteful or morose, men who had been shooting at each other a few hours ago now mingled on the field for which they had fought. Indeed, the occasion was so informal that some Confederates strolled unchallenged through the lines and got away. Bushrod Johnson, who was among those who made off in this manner, later declared, "I have not learned that a single one who attempted to escape met with any obstacle." Apparently Grant, who at this one stroke had captured more prisoners than all the other Union generals combined, did not particularly care. "It is a much less job to take them than to keep them," he said laconically. As for Pillow, he need not have been in such a hurry to escape, Grant told Buckner. "If I had captured him, I would have turned him loose. I would rather have him in command of you fellows than as a prisoner." Throughout the North, church bells rang in earnest this Sunday morning, louder even than they had done for Fort Henry 10 days back. Men embraced on the streets and continued to celebrate into the night by the glare of bonfires. The shame of Bull Run was erased. Indeed, some believed they saw in the smashing double victory the end of armed rebellion, the New York Times remarking, "After this, it certainly cannot be materially postponed. The monster is already clutched and in his death struggle." The nation had a new hero, U.S. Grant, who, by an accident and a coincidence of initials, now became Unconditional Surrender Grant. People had his message to Buckner by heart, and they read avidly of his life and looks in the papers. The features stern, as if carved from mahogany. The clear blue eyes, or gray, some said, and aquiline nose, the strong jaw, squarely set but not sensual. One reporter saw three expressions in his face: deep thought, extreme determination, and great simplicity and calmness. Another saw significance in the way he wore his high-crowned hat. He neither puts it on behind his ears nor draws it over his eyes, much less does he cock it on one side, but sets it straight and very hard on his head. People enjoyed reading of that, and also of the way he would gaze at anyone who approached him with an inquiring air, followed by a glance of recollection and a grave nod of recognition. On horseback, they read, "He sits firmly in the saddle and looks straight ahead, as if only intent on getting to some particular point." The words "square" and "straight" and "firm" were the ones that appeared most often, and people liked them. Best of all, perhaps, they enjoyed hearing that Grant was the concentration of all that is American. He talks bad grammar, but talks it naturally, as much as to say, "I was so brought up, and if I try fine phrases, I shall only appear silly." To them, the whole campaign was an absolute marvel of generalship, a superb combination of simplicity and drive, in welcome contrast to all that had gone before in the West and was continuing in the East. They did not dissect it in search of flaws, did not consider that Grant had started behind schedule, that men had frozen to death because of a lax discipline which let them throw away coats and blankets in fair weather, that individual attacks had been launched without coordination and been bloodily repulsed, nor that the commanding general had been absent from his post for better than 6 critical hours while one of his divisions was being mauled, the other two having been barred by his own orders from lending assistance. They saw rather the sweep and slam-bang power of a leader who marched on Wednesday, skirmished on Thursday, imperturbably watched his fleet's repulse on Friday, fought desperately on Saturday, and received the fort's unconditional surrender on Sunday. Undeterred by wretched weather, the advice of the tactics manuals, or the reported strength of the enemy position, he had inflicted about 2,000 casualties and suffered about 3,000 himself, which was as it should have been, considering his role as the attacker. and now there were something more than 12,000 rebel soldiers, the cream of Confederate volunteers, on their way to northern prison camps to await exchange for as many Union boys who otherwise would have languished in southern prisons under the coming summer sun. People saw Grant as the author of this deliverance, the embodiment of the offensive spirit, the man who would strike and keep on striking until this war was won. 15 years ago, during a lull in the Mexican War, he had written home to the girl he was to marry, "If we have to fight, I would like to do it all at once, and then make friends." Apparently, he still felt that way about it. Church bells were ringing that Sunday morning in Nashville, too, though not in celebration. The celebration had come the night before, following the release of telegrams from Floyd and Pillow announcing a victory complete and glorious. Today, instead, they told the fall of Donelson, the loss of that whole wing of Johnston's army, and the resultant necessity for abandoning the Tennessee capital. All morning the remnants of Hardee's 14,000, reduced to less than two-thirds of that by straggling and sickness during the icy retreat from Bowling Green, filed through the city, harrowing the populace with accounts of Buell's bloodthirsty hordes closing fast upon their rear. Thus began a week of panic. Previously, the war had seemed a far-off thing, over in Virginia or across the Mississippi, or 100 miles north in Kentucky. They had been too busy or too confident to fortify even the river approaches. Now that it was upon them with the abruptness of a pistol shot in a theater, they reacted variously. Some wept in numb despair. Others proposed to burn the city, that the enemy might have nothing of it but the ashes. Terrified by a rumor that Buell's army and Foote's gunboats would converge upon the city at 3 p.m. to shell it into submission, they milled about, loading their household goods onto carts and wagons. By that time, a special train had left from Memphis, with Governor Harris and the state archives aboard. Later that afternoon, the Yankee soldiers and gunboats not having appeared, the mayor informed the crowd in the public square that Johnston had promised to make no stand in Nashville. He himself would go out to meet the Federals and surrender the city before they got there, the mayor told the frantic populace. Meanwhile, they should calm their fears and stay at home. As a final mollification, he promised to distribute among them all the Confederate provisions that could not be removed by Johnston's army. This appeal to the greed of the people, while effective, was to have its consequences. Nashville warehouses were bulging with accumulated supplies, and it was Johnston's task, though he had opposed this placing of all the army's eggs in one basket, to save what he could before the Federals got there. Next morning, when Floyd and his brigade, minus the Mississippians, arrived by steamboat, Johnston put him in charge while he himself continued the retreat with Hardee's men. Floyd took over the railroads, commandeered what few wagons remained, and in general did what he could. The panic had lessened somewhat since the non-arrival of the Federals, but a lurid glare against the northern sky and the clang of fire bells in the night caused its resurgence until the people learned that the reflection, which they had feared might be from torches carried by an army of Yankee incendiaries, was from the hulls of two unfinished Confederate gunboats ordered burned in the yards. Next day, Floyd continued his efforts to save the stores. It was unpleasant work, the citizens growing more mutinous every hour, especially after the destruction over their protest of their two fine bridges across the Cumberland. Floyd was greatly relieved when Forrest arrived from Donelson on Wednesday under orders to assist him in the salvaging of government supplies. So relieved, in fact, that next morning he marched his brigade away and left the task to Forrest and his troopers. Instructed to stay there one more day unless Buell arrived sooner, Forrest stayed four. His iron hand snatched order out of chaos. Rifling machinery and other ordnance equipment, rare items in the Confederacy, were sent from the gun foundry to Atlanta. 250,000 pounds of bacon and hundreds of wagon loads of clothing, flour, and ammunition were hauled to the railroad station for shipment south. The people, seeing this new efficiency and remembering that they had been promised what was left, sought to interfere by gathering in front of the warehouses. Forrest appealed to their patriotism. and when that did not work, ordered his mounted men to lay about with the flat of their sabers, which worked better. One large mob in front of a warehouse on the public square was dispersed by the use of fire hoses, squirting ice-cold muddy water from the river. And as one of the crowd remembered it later, this had a magical effect. All day Thursday and Friday and Saturday, Forrest and his troopers worked, on into Sunday morning when blue pickets appeared on the north bank of the river. Mindful of his instructions to leave Nashville an open city, Forrest fell back through the suburbs, marching to join Johnston and Hardee, who by now were at Murfreesboro, 40 miles southeast. The Army of Central Kentucky, or what was left of it anyhow, would have to find a new name. Nashville's Great Panic, as it was called thereafter, had lasted precisely a week, though by way of anticlimax, one ignominy remained. True to his promise to the people, the mayor got in a rowboat and crossed the river to deliver the city into the hands of the Yankees before they opened fire with their long-range guns. He found no guns, however, and few soldiers, only half a squad of cavalry and one Ohio captain, who, after some persuasion, agreed to receive the surrender of the city, or at any rate not to attack it. The mayor returned and announced this deliverance to the citizens, who thus were relieved of a measure of their fears, most of which had been groundless in the first place. Buell was still a long way off, toiling down the railroad and the turnpike, repairing washed-out bridges as he came. Grant remained at Donelson, receiving reinforcements. Before the end of the week, he had upwards of 30,000 men in four divisions, one of which had been advanced to Clarksville. Nashville would be an easy conquest, he wrote Halleck's chief of staff, but I only throw this out as a suggestion. I am ready for any move the general commanding may order. The general commanding ordered nothing. Grant stayed where he was. Buell, in fact, did not reach Nashville until Wednesday, though several outfits had come on ahead. A reporter with one of the earliest wrote of what they found. All the stores and most of the better homes were closed. The State House was deserted, the legislators having fled with the governor to Memphis, which had been declared the temporary capital. The correspondent found the door of the leading hotel bolted, and when he rang, there was no answer. He kept on ringing with the persistency of a tired and hungry man within reach of food and a clean bed. At last he was rewarded. A Negro swung the door ajar and stood there smiling broadly. "Massa done gone south," he said, still grinning. 3. Inauguration Day broke cold and sullen in Richmond, with a scud of cloud that promised and then delivered rain, first a drizzle, then a steady downpour, hissing and gurgling in the gutters and thrumming against roofs and window panes. Davis rose early, as was his custom. Not due at the ceremonies until 11:30, he walked first to his office for an hour of the paperwork which filled so large a share of his existence, then back home. His wife, coming to warn him that the dignitaries were waiting to escort him to the Capitol, found him alone on his knees in the bedroom, praying for the divine support I need so sorely. That, too, had been his custom since his first inauguration a year ago, under a cloudless Alabama sky. The procession formed in the old Virginia Hall of Delegates, then moved out onto Capitol Square, where a canopied platform had been set up alongside the equestrian statue of Washington, whose birthday this was. Grouped about the president-elect were cabinet officers, admirals and generals, governors and congressmen, newspaper representatives, and members of various benevolent societies. Beside him stood Vice President Stevens, undersized and sickly, huddled in layers of clothes and resembling more than ever a mummified child. Asked once to define true happiness, Stevens had replied without hesitation, "To be warm." He was not happy now, presumably, for a cold rain fell in sheets, blown under the canopy by intermittent gusts of northern wind. When the Right Reverend John Johns, Episcopal Bishop of Virginia, raised his arms to pronounce the invocation, his lawn sleeves hung limp and his heavy satin vestments were splotched with wet. Close packed, the crowd stood and took its drenching, conscious of being present at a historic occasion. Some held strips of canvas or worn carpet over their heads, but there were enough umbrellas to give the square what one witness called the effect of an immense mushroom bed. They could hear few of the words above the impact of the rain. They saw Davis take the oath, however, and they knew they had a permanent president at last. When he bent forward to kiss the book, a shout went up. Then they quieted. The drumming of the rain was loud as he turned to address them. He was thinner and even more austere in appearance, the cheekbones brought into greater prominence and the eyes sunk even deeper in their sockets. Singularly imposing, one witness found him today, albeit with a pallor painful to look upon. He wore a suit of black for the ceremonies instead of his customary gray, so that to Mrs. Davis he seemed a willing victim going to his funeral pyre. Her thoughts had been directed into such channels by an occurrence on the way. Observing that the carriage moved at a snail's pace, accompanied by a quartet of black-suited Negro footmen wearing white cotton gloves, she asked the coachman, to whom she had left the arrangements, what it meant. He told her, "This, ma'am, is the way we always does in Richmond at funerals and sich like." A year ago there had been no talk of funerals. Joyous was the word Davis had used to describe the atmosphere on the day of his first inaugural. It was not so now. The outlook was as different as the weather. Nor did he assume a falsely joyous manner on this second occasion of taking the oath as President of the Confederacy. After referring to the birthday of the Virginian who looked out from his bronze horse nearby, he once more outlined and defended the course of events which had led to secession, characterizing the North as barbarous and expressing scorn for the military despotism which had our enemies in its grip. All this was as it had been before, but soon he passed to words that touched the present. "A million men, it is estimated, are now standing in hostile array and waging war along a frontier of thousands of miles. Battles have been fought, sieges have been conducted, and although the contest is not ended and the tide for the moment is against us, the final result in our favor is not doubtful. We have had our trials and difficulties. That we are to escape them in the future is not to be hoped. It was to be expected when we entered upon this war that it would expose our people to sacrifices and cost them much, both of money and blood. But the picture has its lights as well as its shadows. This great strife has awakened in the people the highest emotions and qualities of the human soul. It was, perhaps, in the ordination of Providence that we were to be taught the value of our liberties by the price we pay for them. The recollection of this great contest, with all its common traditions of glory, of sacrifice and blood, will be the bond of harmony and enduring affection amongst the people, producing unity in policy, fraternity in sentiment, and just effort in war." An invocation had opened the proceedings. Now another closed them. Davis lifted his hands and eyes to heaven as he spoke the final words. "My hope is reverently fixed on him whose favor is ever vouchsafed to the cause which is just. With humble gratitude and adoration, acknowledging the providence which has so visibly protected the Confederacy during its brief but eventful career, to thee, O God, I trustingly commit myself and prayerfully invoke thy blessing on my country and its cause." Under the spell of that closing prayer, the people dispersed in silence and good order, as though they had attended divine service, one remarked. Later, however, away from the magic of his voice and presence, they doubted that there was unity in policy, or fraternity in sentiment, or just effort in the prosecution of the war. Prompted by hostile editors, whose critiques of the address came out in their papers the following day, along with the news from Donelson and Nashville announcing the loss of Kentucky and most of Tennessee, they began to consider not only what he had said, but also what he had not said. He had outlined no future policy for raising the blockade, whose pinch was already being felt, or for overcoming the recent military reverses. Though his words were obviously spoken as much for foreign as for domestic ears, he had not foretold international recognition or the receiving of assistance from abroad. Except in vague and general terms, including the closing appeal to the Almighty, he had announced no single plan for coming to grips with the host of calamities they knew were included in his admission that the tide for the moment is against us. The fact that he refrained from explicit mention of these reverses did not mean that the people were unaware of them. They knew all too well that even a bare listing would have doubled the length of his address. Foremost among the disappointments, at least to men who took a long view of the chance for victory, was the failure of Confederate diplomacy. Original computations had shown that before spring, England would have begun to suffer from the cotton famine which would bring her to her knees. Yet the looms and jennies spinning away at the surplus bulging the warehouses had not slowed. Ironically, the shortage there was not in cotton but in wheat, the result of a crop failure in the British Isles. They were buying it now by the shipload from the north, which had harvested a bumper crop with its new McCormick reapers. Another example of what it meant to fight a race of pasty-faced mechanics. Back at the outset, Southerners had predicted that the Great Northwest, meaning Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Iowa, along with northern Illinois and Indiana, would be pro-Confederate because of its need for an outlet to the Gulf of Mexico. Some who lived there had thought so too. The Detroit Free Press had declared at the time, "If troops shall be raised in the North to march against the people of the South, a fire in the rear will be opened against such troops, which will either stop their march altogether or wonderfully accelerate it." But events had not worked out that way at all. The men of Grant's army were mostly from that region, and they had been accelerated, not by any fire in the rear, but rather by an intense concern that the Union be preserved. Then, too, instead of working in economic hardship, as the Southerners had predicted, the war had provided the farmers of the area with a new and profitable market for their wheat. The Northwest had not only stood by the Union, it was growing rich from having done so. To some, this one among the many was the greatest disappointment of them all. The main hope of redress was that foreign intervention would be won by the new team of professional diplomats, Mason and Slidell, who had made a spectacular entry into the field. Yet here, too, there was disappointment. After serving the South so well from their cells in Boston Harbor, they were proving far less useful now in freedom at their posts. They stepped onto the London railway platform as if into obscurity, unwelcomed and unnoticed, save by the late Friendly Times, which announced their arrival with the following observations. "We sincerely hope that our countrymen will not give these fellows anything in the shape of an ovation. The civility that is due to a foe in distress is all that they can claim. The only reason for their presence in London is to draw us into their own quarrel. The British public has no prejudice in favor of slavery which these gentlemen represent. What they and their secretaries are to do here passes our experience. They are personally nothing to us. They must not suppose, because we have gone to the verge of a great war to rescue them, that they are precious in our eyes." Bitter as it was for Mason to see himself and his partner referred to as unprecious fellows, the reception he received from the foreign minister dampened his spirits even more. Ushered into the presence, he was about to present his credentials when his lordship checked him. "That is unnecessary, since our relations are unofficial." Icily polite, but disinclined to enter into any discussion of policy, the most Earl Russell ventured was the hope that Mason would find his visit agreeable. In parting, he did not express the hope that they might meet again. This was the treatment Yancey had broken under, and the Virginian took it scarcely better, reporting, "On the whole, it was manifest enough that his personal sympathies were not with us." Slidell, continuing his voyage across the Channel, also encountered conditions which had plagued his predecessor. Unlike Mason, he had no difficulty in securing audiences. He got about as many as he wanted, and Eugénie was obviously charmed, a fact which he reported with some pride. But Napoleon would only repeat what he had said before. France could not act without England. That was the crux of the matter. The Crimean War had been a struggle between West and East, which the West had won, and now, in the normal course of events, as demonstrated by history, the victors should have turned upon each other for domination of the whole. Yet it had not worked out that way. There was no such tenuous balance as had obtained at the time of the American Revolution, bringing France to the assistance of the colonies. On the contrary, the Entente remained strong, drawing its strength from the weakness of Napoleon, whose shaky finances and doubtful popularity would not allow him to risk bringing all of Europe down on his unprotected back. Slidell could only inform his government of these conditions. It began to seem that economically and politically, so far at least as Europe was concerned, the South had chosen the wrong decade in which to make her bid for independence. Like others who took the long view, seeing foreign intervention as the one quick, indisputable solution to the Confederacy's being outnumbered and outgunned and outmachined, Davis received this latest news from abroad with whatever grace and patience he could muster. He could wait, though by the hardest. Meantime, he had other more immediate problems here at home, within his own official family, in evidence of which, as even the short-view men could see, the chief post in his cabinet was vacant. The Secretary of State had left in a huff that very week. At the time when he accepted the appointment, Hunter had announced that he intended to be a responsible and independent official, not just the clerk of Mr. Davis. As Virginia's favorite son candidate at the Democratic Convention of 1860, he had his political dignity to consider. Besides, in the early days of the secession movement, when it was thought that the Old Dominion would be among the first to go, he had been slated for the presidency of the impending Confederacy. Virginia had held back, and he had missed it. But there was still the future to keep his eye on, and his dignity to be maintained. The result was a personality clash with Davis, a build-up of bad feeling which reached a climax during a general cabinet discussion of the military situation. When Hunter expressed an opinion on the subject, Davis told him, "Mr. Hunter, you are Secretary of State, and when information is wished of that department, it will be time for you to speak." The Virginian's resignation was on the presidential desk next morning. Davis, of course, accepted it. He made no appointment to fill the post immediately, however. Vacant for a week at the time of the inauguration, it would remain so for three more. The man he had in mind was too deeply embroiled in other matters, filling another cabinet position, to be considered available just yet. And this was one more item which might have been included in any listing of reverses. As Secretary of War, the rotund, smiling Judah P. Benjamin had been under fire almost since the day of his appointment. Not under actual bombardment from the enemy beyond the gates, but rather from the plain citizens and congressmen within, whose ire was aroused by his summary treatment of the nation's military heroes, coming as they did under the jurisdiction of his department. Benjamin had no such notion as Hunter's concerning the duties of his post. As head of the War Department, he considered himself quite literally the President's Secretary for Military Affairs, and it did not irk him at all to be tagged the clerk of Mr. Davis. The field of arms was one of the few that had not previously engaged the interest of this myriad-minded man, whereas Davis, a West Pointer and a Mexican war hero, had been the ablest secretary the Federal War Department ever had. Benjamin's duty, as he saw it, and here the two men's concepts coincided, was to execute the will and, if necessary, defend the actions of his commander-in-chief. Besides, he saw Davis's needs, the desire for warmth behind his iciness, the ache for understanding behind his stiff austerity. Judah Benjamin was one of the few who perceived this, or at any rate one of the few, like Mrs. Davis, who acted on it, and in doing so he not only made himself pleasant, in time he also made himself indispensable. That was his reward. He gained the President's gratitude, and with it the unflinching loyalty which Davis always gave in return for loyalty received. Whatever he lacked in the knowledge of arms as a profession, he brought to his job a considerable facility in the handling of administrative matters. Unlike Walker, who had fumed and stewed in tangles of red tape and never got from under the avalanche of army paperwork, Benjamin would clear his desk with dispatch, then sit back smiling, ready for what came next. What came next, as often as not, was an opportunity for exercising his talent in dialectics. Here his skill was admittedly superior, uncanny, some called it, and they spoke resentfully, for by the precision of his logic he could lead men where they would not go, making them seem clumsy in the process. In taking up his superior's quarrels with the generals on the Manassas line, which seemed to him one of the duties of his post, he gave full play to his talents in this direction, undeterred by awe for the military mind. That was what had caused Beauregard to reach for his pen in such a frenzy, writing with ill-concealed irony of the pity he felt, from the bottom of my heart, for any man who could not see the difference between patriotism, the highest civic virtue, and office-seeking, the lowest civic occupation. It was Benjamin, he meant. But in making the charge, the general entered a field where his fellow Louisianian was master, and presently he went west. Even more vulnerable in this respect, though banishment did not follow so close on the heels of contention, was Joseph E. Johnston. After Johnston's protest at being outranked and Davis's quick slash in reply, Benjamin took up the cudgel for his chief. Johnston was a careless administrator, and whenever he lapsed in this regard, the secretary took him to task with a letter that prickled his sensitive pride. Infuriated, the general would reply in kind, only to be brought up short by another missive which proved him even further in the wrong. A later observer wrote that Benjamin treated the Virginian as if he were an adversary at the bar, but sometimes it was worse. He dealt with him as if he were a prisoner in the dock. Johnston's outraged protests against such treatment did him no more good than Beauregard's had done. Once when the Creole complained to Davis that the secretary's tone was offensive and that he was being put into the straitjackets of the law, the president replied, "I do not feel competent to instruct Mr. Benjamin in the matter of style. There are few whom the public would probably believe fit for the task." As for the second objection, "You surely do not intend to inform me that your army and yourself are outside the limits of the law. It is my duty to see that the laws are faithfully executed, and I cannot recognize the pretensions of anyone that their restraint is too narrow for him." Exalted thus at the expense of those who attempted to match wits with him, Benjamin continued to maintain order at headquarters and to ride herd on recalcitrance among the military. Then, unexpectedly, he ran full tilt into a man who had no use for dialectics, who stood instead on his own ground and gave the secretary his first check. T.J. Jackson, called Stonewall since Manassas, had been promoted to Major General in the fall and assigned to command a division in the Shenandoah Valley, from which strategic location he had proposed that he be reinforced for an all-out invasion of the North. Having just rejected a similar proposal from Beauregard at Centerville, the administration would send him no reinforcements, but attach to his command the three brigades of W.W. Loring, the one professional in the quartet who had tried the patience and damaged the reputation of R.E. Lee in West Virginia. Told to accomplish what he could with this total force of about 9,000, Jackson launched on New Year's Day a movement designed to recover the counties flanking the western rim of the Valley Theater. The first phase of the campaign went as planned. Marching in bitter midwinter weather, Jackson's men harried the B&O Railroad, captured enemy stores, and in general created havoc among the scattered federal camps. This done, Stonewall stationed Loring's troops at Romney on the upper Potomac and took the others back to Winchester, 30-odd miles eastward, to begin the second phase. Just what that would have been remained a mystery, for Jackson was a most secretive man, agreeing absolutely with Frederick II's remark, "If I thought my coat knew my plans, I would take it off and burn it." He did say, however, that he left the attached brigades on outpost duty because his own were better marchers and could move more swiftly toward any threatened point. Loring's volunteers did not subscribe to this. Rather, it was their belief that Stonewall was demented. They saw various symptoms of this, including the fact that he never took pepper in his food, on grounds that it gave him pains in his left leg. And so were his men, for that matter, since they had a habit of cheering him on the march. Exposed as they were to the elements and the possible swoop of federal combinations, Loring and his officers petitioned the War Department to withdraw them from their uncomfortable position. On the next to last day of January, Jackson received the following dispatch signed by Benjamin. "Our news indicates that a movement is being made to cut off General Loring's command. Order him back to Winchester immediately." Jackson promptly complied with the order. Acknowledging its receipt and reporting its execution, the next day he addressed the War Department. "With such interference in my command, I cannot expect to be of much service in the field." Wherefore he asked to be returned to his teaching job at VMI, or else, "I respectfully request that the President will accept my resignation from the Army." The letter went through channels to Johnston, who forwarded it regretfully to Richmond. He, too, had been bypassed, and he told Benjamin, "Let me suggest that having broken up the dispositions of the military commander, you give whatever other orders may be necessary." Eventually, the trouble was smoothed over, and Jackson's resignation returned to him, Governor Letcher and various congressmen exerting all the pressure of their influence. But not before violent recriminations had been heaped on the head of the smiling secretary, especially by Stonewall's fellow officers. Tom Cobb of Georgia, a brigadier in the Virginia Army, stated flatly, "A grander rascal than this Jew Benjamin does not exist in the Confederacy, and I am not particular in concealing my opinion of him." Nor were others particular in that respect, their fury being increased when Loring was promoted in mid-February and taken from under the stern control of Jackson, who had recommended that he be cashiered. Benjamin kept smiling through it all, though by then the indestructibility of his smile was being tested even further. Previous recriminations had come mainly from Army men, outraged at his interfering in tactical matters. Now he was being condemned by the public at large, and for a lack of similar interference. Down on the North Carolina coast, set one above the other, Albemarle and Pamlico Sounds were divided by a low-lying marshy peninsula. At its eastern tip, where the jut of land approached the narrow sands of the breakwater guarding the coast from the gales that blew so frequently off Hatteras, lay Roanoke Island, the site of Raleigh's lost colony and birthplace of the first English child born in the Western Hemisphere. Just now, however, this boggy tract had an importance beyond the historic. Pamlico, the lower and larger sound, had fallen to Stringham's gunboats back in August. Albemarle could be taken, too, once the narrows flanking the island had been forced. Loss of the lower sound had given the Federals a year-round anchorage and access to New Bern, principal eastern depot on the vital railroad supply line to Richmond and the armies in Virginia. That was bad enough, though the invaders had not yet exploited it. But loss of the upper sound would expose Norfolk and Gosport Navy Yard to attack from the rear. This would be worse than bad. It would be tragic, for the Confederates had things going on in the Navy Yard that would not bear interruption. The focal point for its defense, as anyone could see, was Roanoke Island. Situated north of all four barrier inlets, it was like a loose-fitting cork plugging the neck of a bottle called Albemarle Sound. Nothing that went by water could get in there without going past the cork. One who saw this clearly was Henry Wise. Still seething from his defeat in West Virginia at the hands of his fellow ex-governor Floyd, he arrived and took command of the island forces in late December. He entered upon his duties with his usual enthusiasm. By the time he was halfway through his first inspection, however, he saw that the cork was not only loose, but also apt to crumble under pressure. Little had been done to block the passes, either by driving pilings or by sinking obstructions in the channel. What was worse, the water batteries were badly sighted, clustered up at the northern end of the island as if in expectation of attack from that direction after Norfolk fell, while the southern end, giving down upon Pamlico Sound, which the enemy fleet had held for 4 months now, was left open to amphibious assault. In the face of this threat, Wise had a garrison of about 2,500 men, fewer than he believed were necessary to slow, let alone halt, such an attack once the Federals got ashore. Yet he was no defeatist. He got to work, driving pilings and sinking hulks in the channel, and called on the district commander at Norfolk, Major General Benjamin Huger, for additional artillery and ammunition, pile drivers, supplies of every kind, and especially more soldiers. A 56-year-old South Carolina aristocrat, West Pointer and Chief of Ordnance under Scott in Mexico, Huger was placid in manner and deliberate in judgment. He had never inspected the island defenses, but he replied to Wise's requisitions by recommending hard work and coolness among the troops you have, instead of more men. Being told to keep cool only lowered Wise's boiling point, which was reached when Flag Officer William F. Lynch of the Confederate Navy commandeered all his workboats except a single tug, converting them to one-gun gunboats. A mosquito fleet, Wise dubbed the result in derision, and left for Norfolk to protest in person. When Huger still gave him no satisfaction, he set out for Richmond, where he had influential friends bound to him during years of politics. He would appeal directly to the Secretary of War. This was contrary to Army regulations, he knew. To go was to risk court-martial, but he believed the situation justified irregularity. "Damn the execution, sir," he had cried in West Virginia. "It's the sound that we want." As tactics, this could be applied to more than field artillery. Arriving January 19th, he stayed 3 days, but he got nowhere with the secretary. Already Benjamin had replied to his urgent demands for cannon powder by informing him that the Confederacy's very limited reserve was being saved for use at more closely threatened points. At the first indication, however, of an attack on Roanoke Island, he wrote, "a supply will be sent you." Wise replied that there was no more closely threatened point, and that once the assault had begun it would be too late, but the secretary had considered the matter closed. Now, face to face with Benjamin in Richmond, the Virginian fared no better in his plea for powder, nor did he get reinforcements. When he pointed out that Huger had 13,000 men lying idle around Norfolk, the secretary, obviously preferring the military judgment of the professionally trained senior to that of the politically appointed subordinate, shrugged and said that he supposed the district commander knew best. He would not interfere. Wise remained in town, complaining vociferously to his high-placed friends until the 22nd, when a dispatch arrived from Commander Lynch announcing symptoms of an enemy build-up and attack. Whereupon Benjamin, doubtless glad to be rid of him, issued a peremptory order for the general to go back to his island post. Bad weather and transportation difficulties delayed his return till the end of the month. On the 31st, while Stonewall Jackson was composing his resignation out in the valley, the distraught Wise, his condition aggravated by the frustration of trying to get someone to realize the weakness of his tactical position, took to his bed with a severe attack of pleurisy. He was still there a week later when the all-out federal amphibious assault was launched, just as he had said it would be, against the undefended south end of the island. In his search for someone who understood the difficulties and dangers of his assignment, Wise was cut off from the one person who, next to himself, appreciated them best. The trouble was the man wore blue and exercised his authority on the other side of the line. Ambrose Burnside had not gone home with his Rhode Islanders when they were mustered out in early August, 2 weeks after crossing Bull Run as the fist of the roundhouse right McDowell had swung at Beauregard in an effort to end the war on the plains of Manassas. He had tried civilian life as a businessman a few years back, and failing, hadn't liked it. Now, at 37, an Indiana-born West Pointer and a veteran of the Mexican War, he accepted promotion to brigadier and stayed on in the service. A tall, rather stout, energetic man with large features and dark-socketed eyes, He made up for his premature baldness with a fantastic set of whiskers describing a double parabola from in front of his ears, down over his chops, and up across his mouth. This was his trademark, a half-ruff of facial hair standing out in dark brown contrast to his shaven jowls and chin. Affecting the casual in his dress, low-slung holster, loose-fitting knee-length double-breasted jacket, and wide-brimmed, bell-crowned, soft-felt hat. He was something of a pistol-slapper, but likable all the same for his hearty manner and open nature, his forthright outgoing friendliness. McClellan liked him at any rate and called him Dear Byrne in letters. So that when Burnside approached him in the fall with a plan for the seizure of coastal North Carolina, completing what had been begun at Hatteras Inlet and opening thereby a second front in the Confederate rear, the general-in-chief was attentive and said he would like to see it submitted in writing. Burnside did so, expanding his original plan, and McClellan liked it even more. He endorsed it, got the Secretary of War to give it top priority, and told the Hoosier general to go ahead. The quicker the better. The Burnside expedition, as it was designated, was assembled and ready for action by early January, Annapolis being the staging area for its 13,000 troops and 80 vessels. Grouped into three divisions under brigadiers who had been cadets with their commander at West Point, J.G. Foster, Jesse L. Reno, John G. Park, three of my most trusted friends, he called them. The men were mostly rock-ribbed New Englanders, many of whom would be familiar with the coasting trade and among whom would be found a goodly number of mechanics. The naval components of this task force, under Rear Admiral Lewis M. Goldsborough, a big slack-bodied regular of the type called barnacles, had no such homogeneity. In addition to 20 light-draft gunboats armed with cannon salvaged from the armories of various navy yards, there was a rickety lot of 60-odd transports and supply ships, including tugs, ferries, converted barges, and flat-bottomed river steamers, a conglomeration, in short, of whatever could be scraped together by purchasing agents combing northern rivers and harbors for vessels rejected by agents who had come and gone before them. The only characteristic they shared was that they all drew less than 8 feet of water, the reported high tide depth across the bar at Hatteras Inlet. This was the cause of much grumbling at the outset. Seafaring men among the soldiers took one look at the shallow draft transports and shook their heads. At the worst, they had volunteered for getting shot at, not drowned, which was what they believed would happen once those tubs reached open water. Burnside answered the grumbling by taking the smallest, least seaworthy craft of the lot for his headquarters boat. Thus reassured, or anyhow reproached, the troops filed onto the transports, and on the morning of the 9th, the flotilla steamed out of the harbor to rendezvous next day off Fort Monroe. On the 11th, clearing Hampton Roads, the skippers broke open their sealed orders and steered south. The near mutiny among his seagoing soldiers at the outset was only the first of Burnside's troubles. In fact, the method by which he had quelled the grumbling almost cost him his life the following night, when the fleet ran into a gale off Hatteras. The dinky little headquarters boat got into the trough of the sea and nearly foundered. As he remembered it years later, still somewhat queasy from the experience, everything not securely lashed above decks was swept overboard, while men, furniture, and crockery below decks were thrown about in a most promiscuous manner. Eventually, her steersman brought her head to, and she rode the storm out, staggering up and down the mast-high waves to arrive next morning off Hatteras Inlet, the entrance to Pamlico Sound, where an even worse shock awaited him. The water through there was not 8 feet deep, as he had been told, but 6, which barred many of his vessels from a share in the expedition as effectively as if they had been sunk by enemy action. Here was where the goodly number of mechanics, familiar with the coasting trade, stood their commander in good stead. The tide running swift above the swash, they sent several of the larger ships full speed ahead to ground on the bar, and held them there with tugs and anchors, while the racing current washed the sand from under their bottoms. It was a slow process, bumping them forward length by length, but it worked. By early February, a broad 8-foot channel had been cut, and the fleet assembled safely in the Sound. On the 4th, after a conference with the flag officer, Burnside gave his brigadiers detailed instructions for the landing on Roanoke Island. Another 2-day blow delayed it, but on the morning of the 7th, a fine, clear day with sunshine bright on the placid sapphire water, the fleet steamed forward in attack formation. Still suffering from the multiple pangs of pleurisy and frustration, Wise had been confined all this time at Nag's Head, the Confederate command post on the sandy rim of Albemarle Sound, just opposite the north end of the island. He knew what was coming, and even how, though until now he had not realized the strength of the blow the Federals were aiming. Goldsboro's warships were out in front, mounting a total of 64 guns, eager to take on the 7 makeshift rebel vessels, each mounting a single 32-pounder rifle. Behind the Yankee gunboats came the transports, crowded with 13,000 assault troops ready to swarm ashore and try their strength against the island's fewer than 3,000 defenders. The Mosquito fleet took station in front of the uncompleted line of pilings Wise had started driving across the channel. But when the Federals roared and bore down on them, belching smoke and flame from 9-inch guns and 100-pounder rifles, they scurried back through the gap and out of range, leaving the water batteries to take up the defense. There were 2 of these, both up toward the northern end of the island, and while the warships took them under fire, the transports dropped anchor 3 miles astern and began unloading troops for the landing at Ashby's Harbor, midway up the island's 10-mile length. The first boats hit the beach at 4 o'clock. All this time, the duel between the gunboats and the batteries continued, with more noise than damage on either side. At sundown, the Mosquito fleet attempted a darting attack that was repulsed about as soon as it began. By midnight, all the troops were ashore. The undefended southern half of the island had been secured without the infantry firing a shot. Drenched by a chill rain, they tried to get what sleep they could before the dawn advance, knowing that tomorrow would be tougher. Down the boggy center of the island, a little more than a mile from the opposite beaches, ran a causeway. Astride this backbone of defense, the Confederates had placed a 3-gun battery supported by infantry and flanked by quicksand marshes judged impenetrable. To advance along the causeway toward those guns would be like walking up a hardwood alley toward a bowler whose only worry was running out of balls before the advancer ran out of legs. Yet there was no other way, and the men of both armies knew it. Burnside as well as anyone, for he had been briefed for the landing by a 20-year-old contraband who had run away from his island master the week before and was thoroughly familiar with the dispositions for defense. Instructing Foster to charge straight up the causeway while Reno and Park were probing the boggy flanks, Burnside put all 3 brigades into line and sent them forward as soon as the light was full. Right off, the center brigade ran into murderous head-on fire. Bowled over and pinned down, they were hugging the sandy embankment and wondering what came next. When off to the right and left fronts, they heard simultaneous whoops of exultation. The flank brigades had made it through the knee-deep ooze and slush of the impenetrable marsh. While the rebel cannoneers tried frantically to turn their guns to meet these attacks from opposite and unexpected directions, the men along the causeway jumped up, whooping too, and joined the charge. The battery was quickly overrun. With the fall of the 3-gun battery, the island's defenses collapsed of a broken backbone. Burnside's infantry broke into the clear, taking the water batteries in reverse while the fleet continued its bombardment from the channel. By mid-afternoon, the Confederates had retreated as far as they could go. Corralled on the northern tip of the island, their ammunition exhausted, they laid down their arms. Casualties had been relatively light on both sides, 264 for the attackers, 143 for the defenders. The difference came in the fruits of victory. 2,675 soldiers and 32 cannon were surrendered, losses which the South could ill afford. Best of all, from the northern point of view, Burnside had won control of North Carolina's inland sea, thereby tightening the blockade one hard twist more, opening a second front in the Virginia Army's rear, gaining access to the back door to Norfolk, and arousing the immediate apprehension of every rebel posted within gunshot of salt water. No beach was safe. This newly bred amphibious beast, like some monster out of mythology, half army, half navy, an improbable, unholy combination if ever there was one, might come splashing and roaring ashore at any point from here on down. North and South, the news went out and men reacted. In New York, Horace Greeley swung immediately to the Manic, celebrating the double conquest of Roanoke Island and Fort Henry even as Grant was knocking at the gates of Donelson. The cause of the Union now marches on in every section of the country. Every blow tells fearfully against the rebellion. The rebels themselves are panic-stricken or despondent. It now requires no very far-reaching prophet to predict the end of this struggle. In Richmond, as elsewhere throughout the Confederacy and among her representatives overseas, the spirits of men were correspondingly grim. As if in confirmation of Greeley's paean in the Tribune, letters came from Mason and Slidell. The former wrote from London that the late reverses have had an unfortunate effect upon the minds of our friends here. The latter wrote from Paris, "I need not say how unfavorable an influence these defeats, following in such quick succession, have produced in public sentiment. If not soon counterbalanced by some decisive success of our arms, we may not only bid adieu to all hopes of seasonable recognition, but must expect that the declaration of the inefficiency of the blockade, to which I had looked forward with great confidence at no distant day, will be indefinitely postponed." These were hard lines for Davis on the eve of his inaugural, but he had other reactions to deal with, nearer and far more violent. Norfolk was in turmoil, with good cause. Lynch's Mosquito Fleet, attempting to make a stand against Goldsboro's gunboats at the mouth of the Pasquotank River, was wrecked in short order, 6 of the 7 vessels being captured, rammed, blown up, or otherwise sunk. Only one made its escape up the river and through the dismal swamp canal to Norfolk, barely 40 miles away, bringing wild stories of the destruction it had run from and predicting that Norfolk was next on the monster's list. The consternation which followed this report was hardly calmed by the arrival of Wise, who, convalescent from pleurisy, had made his escape by marching up the breakwater from Nag's Head. "Nothing, nothing, nothing," he proclaimed. "That was the disease which brought disaster at Roanoke Island." Thus he shook whatever confidence the citizens had managed to retain in Eugene, who was charged with their defense. The city seethed with rumors of doom, and the panic spread quickly up the James to Richmond. Davis met it as he had met the East Tennessee crisis early that winter. 5 days after the inaugural in which he had excoriated Lincoln for doing the same thing, and scorned the northern populace for putting up with it, he suspended the privilege of habeas corpus in the Norfolk area, placing the city under martial law. 2 days later, March 1st, Richmond itself was gripped by the Iron Hand. This action added fuel to the fire already raging in certain breasts. Taking their cue from Wise, who was vociferous in accusation, the people put the blame where he pointed, squarely at the Secretary of War. Benjamin took it as he took everything, blandly. "To do the Secretary justice," one observer wrote, "he bore the universal attack with admirable good nature and sang-froid." More than that, to all appearances, equally secure in his own views and indifferent to public odium, he passed from reverse to reverse with perfectly bland manner and unwearying courtesy. The principal charge against him was that he had failed, despite repeated pleas, to supply the island defenders with powder for their cannon. He had the best possible answer to this. that there was and had been none to send, but to admit as much would have been to encourage his country's enemies and alienate the Europeans considering recognition and support. The Louisianian kept silent under attack and abuse, and Davis was given further proof of his loyalty and devotion to the cause. However, his very urbanity was more infuriating to his foes than any defense or counterattack he might have made. The Richmond Examiner was irked into commenting acidly, "The administration has now an opportunity of making some reputation, for nothing being expected of it, of course every success will be clear gain." Plainly, the ultimate sacrifice was called for. Benjamin had to go. He had to go, but not from the cabinet entirely. That would be a loss which Davis believed the nation could not afford. At any rate, he could not. And though, as always, he would not attempt to justify or even explain his action, would not say to the hostile editors and fuming politicians, "Let me keep this man, I need him," he found a way to keep him. A way, however, that infuriated his critics even more. The post of Secretary of State had been vacant since Hunter left in a huff the month before. Davis had kept it so, with this in mind. Now, in mid-March, the permanent Congress, which had convened 4 days before his inauguration, received for confirmation the name of the man he wanted appointed to fill the vacancy. Judah P. Benjamin of Louisiana, former Attorney General and present